Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we're discussing the Trump administration unleashing terror in communities across the country in an attempt to deport 1 million people. The Republican budget bill, which includes $170 billion in funding to, quote, supercharge immigration enforcement, will allow the Trump administration to ramp up their aggressive campaign of raids, arrests, detentions, and deportations. That bill is now law. The plan is to arrest 7,000 people every day for the remainder of the administration. They always say they're deporting criminals, what they call the worst of the worst. But on June 20th, the Cato Institute released non-public data from ICE. It found 65% of people taken by ICE had no convictions, and 93% had no violent convictions. And yet, immigrant communities are living in a state of fear, with people too afraid to go to work, send their kids to school, or seek medical help. Here are a few headlines from the past couple of weeks. Why did this farm worker die in an immigration raid? That's from today's guest, David Bacon, writing in The Nation about Jaime Alanis Garcia. This one's from ProPublica. He came to the U.S. to support his sick child. He was detained, then he disappeared. Like most of the more than 230 Venezuelan men deported to a Salvadoran prison, Jose Manuel Ramos Bastidas had followed U.S. immigration rules, and then Trump rewrote them. This is from Ms. Magazine. Men are impersonating ICE to attack immigrant women. MAGA emboldened them. From The Guardian, migrants in ICE jail in Miami made to kneel to eat like dogs, according to a report. And the PBS NewsHour reports that the IRS is sharing personal data with immigration agents to aid deportation efforts. So how are advocates and lawyers responding? Today we're joined by three guests. Dr. William Lopez is professor of public health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. His work and advocacy focuses on the health impacts of law enforcement, including surveillance, arrest, incarceration, and deportation in communities of color. Dr. Lopez is the author of several books about the impact of deportation on immigrant communities, including Separated, Family and Community in the Aftermath of an Immigration Raid. His forthcoming book is called Raiding the Heartland, an American Story of Deportation and Resistance. It focuses on how communities responded to and were harmed by the massive number of deportations that happened under the first Trump administration. It'll be out in September. And Dr. William Lopez goes by Bill. Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
Victoria Petty is staff attorney for immigrant justice at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area. Victoria focuses on civil litigation to disrupt systemic civil rights violations against immigrants. This work includes challenges to prolonged ICE detention, investigations of unlawful and abusive conditions in California ICE facilities, and lawsuits to seek financial reparations for families separated under the 2018 Trump zero tolerance policy. Hi, Victoria. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by David Bacon, a California-based writer and photographer who's been documenting the lives of migrants and farm workers since 1986. David is the author of many books, including The Children of NAFTA, Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. His latest book of photos and narratives about the Mexico-U.S. border is called More Than a Wall. David was a factory worker and union organizer for two decades with many unions, including the United Farm Workers. You can find his latest piece in The Nation, Why Did This Farm Worker Die in an Immigration Raid? On our website, kalw.org, click news, and then Your Call. Hi, David. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Rose.
Well, David, I want to start off with you. We will talk about your piece about Jaime Alanis Garcia in just a few minutes. But first, you have been documenting the lives of migrants and farm workers for nearly 30 years. You send out a regular newsletter with really beautiful and often devastating photos of what is happening. What are your thoughts about how the second Trump term compares to the first Trump term and other administrations who carried out massive deportations?
Well, thanks for the good words, Rose. I really appreciate it. Well, it's complicated. The current Trump term, I think, is being much more open about its use of terror tactics than it was the first time around. You know, the sending the National Guard into Los Angeles, what we saw in Carpinteria and Camarillo in that raid in which Jaime Alanis died, was really, the immigration agents show up in these military transport vehicles. Nobody has any license plates. Nobody's wearing any identification. You know, the whole idea is to terrorize communities. And I think that immigration raids have always had an element of terror in them. I remember when I worked for the United Farm Workers and saw my first immigration raid. I grew up in Oakland, so I was pretty ignorant. And this was in a grove of palm trees, date palm trees in the Coachella Valley. And I saw the van arrive and start loading people into it that I had talked to the evening before in a union meeting. But the reality was that in that period of time, in the 1970s, those people who were picked up came back to vote in a union election a couple of weeks later. So movement across the border was much more possible. And even though that raid had a certain element of terror in it, it was not like what we're seeing today. What we're seeing today, I think, is really an effort to really terrorize communities. Partly also, I think, in order to stop communities from resisting. I think the Trump administration and ICE officials are worried about what I've seen, for instance, in towns like Santa Maria, in Delano, even here in the Bay Area in San Mateo, where you have young people who are coming out on marches to protest the raids, saying specifically that they are demonstrating for their parents. These are generally young people who are citizens, who were born here in families where their parents are undocumented, and saying it's too dangerous, too risky for our parents to be out there, but we demand that this stop, and we are going to come out there. So I think that that's new, too. I haven't seen that before, and that gives me a lot of hope, because I look at that as being our new generation of organizers, and also I'm inspired by the courage of young people. So I think that that's a new thing that's happening, too. It's both an increase in the terror, but also an increase in the resistance.
Bill, what would you add? What really strikes you about the second Trump term compared to his first, and then other administrations, especially the Obama administration? Vox had a piece on June 17th that said Trump is actually deporting fewer people than Obama did. But because of this additional funding and what they're planning, the numbers will likely surpass what Obama did. So it's also important to recognize that this is not new, but the way that they're going about it is just so brutal. And in many cases, you did not see what we're seeing on these streets like we did under the today versus the Obama administration.
Yeah, absolutely, Rose. It's a great question. And I think David, first of all, David, thank you for your work. And David hit on so many of the important points, right? So immigration enforcement is always meant to be visible, right? So politicians choose an enforcement method that they want to be seen by the public. We remember when Trump was advocating to build a wall, right? That was going along with his other policy rhetoric at the same time. And we've seen many other styles of enforcement. So you're correct that, Barack Obama deported about 500,000 people a year, but his method was not in the same worksite raid or home raid that of the current Trump administration, because he was trying to show something different. Going back to President Bush, we remember President Bush had these large-scale worksite raids, and many of us, I'm sure, those of you who've been doing this work for a long time, remember the raid in Postville, Iowa. And Bush was trying to show that he was being firm on workers and those who hire immigrants, right? But then pushback followed all of these. And to give, so going back to your question of what is the difference between previous administrations and the Trump administration now, A similarity is that what he's doing is meant to be seen. A difference is that what he wants to be seen is the cruelty, right? And I think about Adam Serwer's essays in The Atlantic, right, that the cruelty is the point. We really started to think about that, and that coalesced in the public mindset in the first Trump administration. I would add in the second Trump administration, we're also seeing that the chaos is the point. Trump is purposefully causing fear. And as you said, you know, at the top of the piece, Rose, this fear is meant to keep people indoors, kids out of school, people out of work, even customers out of restaurants, right? So we're seeing this visible fear and the impacts spread over whole communities. I think to wrap up, again, one big change is also not just in the president's handling of these issues, but in the public's. I absolutely agree that there's just so much advocacy now and so much public presence quickly. Part of this is how well advocates have used social media. Part of this is the anger. But I will say part of it is also what we'd call coalitional work or collaboration across groups. So my work focuses on many of the enforcement instances that happen in the Midwest and in rural areas, where unfortunately we often don't have the sheer number of immigrant families, often Latino families, to show up in the way that thankfully they have in LA. But we see folks, you know, across racial group, across class, across citizenship status, right? People are being able to advocate and do so publicly in a way that I hadn't seen before, as more and more people realize that mass deportation is going to involve everyone and is going to involve mass public consent, and we're refusing to give that consent.
Victoria, what would you add?
What I would add is something that seems distinct to me from the first Trump administration has little necessarily to do with Donald Trump. The scale of detention under the Trump 1 administration did not have the same financial means, as you alluded to at the top of the interview. The new budget bill has radically increased funding for ICE detention. The American Immigration Council expects that the number of beds will increase from around 50,000 to about 100,000 beds for people to be detained. Whereas under Trump 1, there was a lot of litigation around decreasing the population in detention because of the COVID-19 pandemic. There were caps placed on various facilities for failure to adhere to COVID safety protocols. And so just the number of people who are subjected to detention was not at the scales that we are seeing today. They are really using detention as a primary arm of their enforcement tactics. Another distinction that we're seeing now is just the willingness to flout court orders. We see our judicial system as a co-equal branch of government that has the authority to interpret the law and prohibit the executive branch from acting and engaging in conduct that is contrary to the law. And when a court order comes down from a federal judge at any level of the system, everyone's expectation is that that rule will be followed. And under this administration, we have to plan and risk assess for the likelihood that even if we are successful in getting a court order that correctly interprets the law and instructs the executive branch to stop its conduct, we have to plan for the event that they do not follow that order. And I think that's a really scary reality for lawyers to live in under this second administration, in addition to our clients.
Can you elaborate on this a bit, Victoria? Because the Trump administration is just pushing legal boundaries across the board to meet their goals of, well, first it was 650 a day and then 3,000 a day, and now they say 7,000 a day. We'll talk about the lawsuit that you're involved with in a minute, but what are you hearing when you speak with your colleagues about the role that the law is playing in all of this? Because I mean, it's shocking to read some of these articles about how migrants are being disappeared. I mean, this is not an exaggeration. Families do not know, in some cases, where their loved ones are. I mean, ProPublica has this really devastating, very long piece they wrote with the Texas Tribune. He came to the U.S. to support his sick child. He was detained and then he disappeared. His family has Jose Manuel Ramos Bastidas. They have no idea where he is. He was sent to a Salvadoran prison. So can you just talk about what you and other lawyers are doing, what you can do at this time?
Well, I think what we can do is that we are, first of all, always trying to be responsive to the lived experience on the ground. People are living in fear, as Bill talked about, at just the most basic sites of social and civic participation. And so I think listening to people on the ground and being a part of the movement is, you know, number one that lawyers are kind of charging ourselves with always, but especially today. I think that the role of the law in all of this is so scary. Part of the legal landscape that we are facing these days is the willingness to use outdated or old, antiquated sources of law, such as the Alien Enemies Act, which is from the 1700s, which has been rarely used in the past as a weapon of immigration enforcement. The willingness to place people in detention and use ICE's legal authority to move people between detention centers at will, far away from their families, far away from their legal representatives, away from anyone who can help them to either to help them, you know, escape the kind of claws that they've found themselves in. The ICE's, you know, using its authority, its discretion to place people wherever it may, and usually that's in faraway remote locations. And so I think that being vigilant and being willing and able to risk assess and plan for the absolute worst is something that lawyers are always charged with doing. But these days, I think that the scope is just so much broader.
What would you add, Bill? There is a really incredible Facebook page called The Disappeared, and it's run by, I need to find out who it's run by, but I've been following this, and it's a credible site. I'll just read this right now. The men highlighted here were deported under the Alien Enemies Act, many without any opportunity to contest their removal in court or to even understand what was happening to them. Once in El Salvador, they were transferred to CECOT, that's that Supermax prison, infamous for its inhumane conditions. And so there's story after story of these men who've been transferred to this jail. In some cases, they were able to call their loved ones. In other cases, their loved ones have no idea what happened to them.
Yeah, I think this is tragic. One thing that is often easy, I think, for the public to miss, you know, Rose and Victoria, you both use the word disappearing, or they've disappeared them. And I think many Latinos with roots in Mexico or Central America, or perhaps, you know, we've learned about this in our classes through our families. We've grown up knowing that word disappeared, right? We know that a government can make someone disappear. And it's been a strategy of governments in Mexico and Central America, you know, in the 80s and 90s during Civil War. So it's pulling from this long history of fascist governments doing this to people for a few reasons. And one is certainly to break up families, to frustrate them so that the emotional drain is so big, there's no remaining emotion to put toward fighting the case, right? I think Victoria raised a really good point that part of the strategy is disappearing people or otherwise moving them to far off locations. One of the things that we see, especially in rural areas, is that it is so much harder to win an immigration case when no one can reach you. Some of that is obvious, but some of the reasons simply include lawyers have many clients and they're not inclined to drive to their faraway clients when they have 10 other emergencies in their hometown. So this strategy of disappearing somebody and then locating them far away from the city as possible, right, is just meant to crack families and reduce their energy so they can't possibly fight and can't possibly win these cases. And we just know that the psychological burden of somebody disappearing is different than the burden of a deportation, is even different than the burden of death. And I'm certainly not comparing and saying one is better or worse than the other. I'm saying that the weight of not knowing has known psychological impacts on the families who are wondering where their loved ones are.
David, have you heard of anyone who's been disappeared in the communities you cover?
Well, certainly there were people who disappeared temporarily in the wake of the raid in Carpinteria and Camarillo. ICE would take them into custody, and then the families wouldn't be able to locate them. They weren't on the database, and it took, in most cases, some days for the families to locate them. It is really horrible what is happening as far as sending people to the prison in El Salvador or sending people to the South Sudan. But I think the intention of it is worth looking at really closely. And it has to do, I think, with what Victoria was saying about the Trump administration. It really doesn't care about the law. 200 people, 300 people in that prison in El Salvador is what it's like. Just a small percentage of the people that the Trump administration is saying that they are going to deport every day. So the intention and the purpose of it is also the terror. Gregory Bovino, who heads the Southern District of the Border Patrol that encompasses Los Angeles and Southern California, said clearly, we gave people a chance to self-deport. Now we're going to help them along a little bit. What does that mean? It means that the whole intention of this is to create a situation that is so unlivable and so fearful that people leave. And then Tom Homan, he had another quote that was really interesting too, where he said that if the rhetoric keeps increasing, somebody is going to die. That's practically inevitable. So here he is threatening people who resist this with essentially death. And it was no accident, I think, that Jaime Lanis died in that grow house a week later. I have a friend, Alfredo Juarez Lillo, who was an organizer of farm workers up in Washington State. And he was targeted by ICE back in March and was detained on his way to work. They knew who he was, they were following him. And they did this because of his activity. And then he was thrown into the detention center in Tacoma, where he languished up until about a week ago. The Trump administration contested his bail. They kept him there. And eventually, Lilo said, I'm choosing to take voluntary departure because, first of all, I can't stand being in here any longer. And second, because people are winning their bail rights and winning their cases here in the center, and the Trump administration is deporting them anyway. So, Lilo was essentially forced into self-deportation by this kind of punishing imprisonment. And the purpose of it is not only to frighten people, but also to remove somebody who ICE and the administration clearly looked at as being a potential source of danger. So I think that the enforcement wave here is also targeting people. And that's important too, because it's targeting people not just to create a sort of general climate of fear, but also to specifically to say to people, don't resist, because if you do resist, these are the consequences. And that was what Tom Homan was saying.
David, you just reminded me of a story about self-deportation by Juliana Kim at NPR. This ran last month. I just want to read a bit from this because it's so important and it's so hard to wrap your head around this. For 55-year-old U.S. Army veteran Se Jun Park, this was the hardest moment of his life. not getting shot in combat, not the years battling post-traumatic stress disorder or addiction, not prison. It was leaving the U.S., a country he called home for nearly 5 decades. Park, a green card holder, self-deported to South Korea. His removal order was the result of charges related to drug possession and failure to appear in court from over 15 years ago. Offenses, he said, stemmed from years of untreated PTSD. His story reflects the challenges of life after combat and the perils that non-citizen veterans face if caught in the legal system, realities made harsher amid the Trump administration's push for record deportations. He told NPR, "I cannot believe this is happening in America. That blows me away like a country that I fought for." I mean, it's you can't even imagine this. He's going to a country he does not know. He was living in Hawaii, and at a meeting with a local ICE official, he was warned that he would be detained and deported unless he left voluntarily. So he booked his flight, spent his final days in the U.S. He doesn't think he'll ever see his 85-year-old mom again. I mean, David, this is you can't even comprehend this. He doesn't even know South Korea.
Well, yes, and that speaks to the level of fear that is the tool and the weapon that's being used to force people to make these terrible decisions. I think most of the people who are being deported have not seen the countries that they came from for a long, long time, you know, especially young people who possibly came here as infants or children and have really no memories of where they came from. But I think that also the use of this self-deportation weapon is an old weapon in U.S. immigration history and in the history of immigration enforcement. In the 1930s, the U.S. deported many, many hundreds of thousands of people, loading people onto boxcars, even citizens, and then sending them down to the border. But that went along with the terror that inspired, forcing people to choose between living in fear and going home. And in those days, it was called repatriation. So this kind of self-deportation existed during the McCarthy period, existed during the 1950s, where the U.S. deported over 1 million people, but where also many, many people left the United States because of that level of fear. And I think also the other part of this we're not really talking about here is that that was also the same year in which, 1954, in which the U.S., allowed growers to bring 450,000 people from Mexico in the kind of semi-slave labor program that was called the Bracero program. Mm-hmm. So this was also about furnishing growers and agriculture, and remember who Trump's big contributors are, with a very, very low-wage, controlled, exploitable labor force that would basically continue making the money. So that's kind of the flip side of what we're seeing right now.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are talking about the Trump administration unleashing terror in communities across the country in an attempt to deport 1 million people. The Republican budget law includes $170 billion in funding to, quote, supercharge immigration enforcement. The administration's plan is to now arrest 7,000 people every day for the remainder of the administration. And over the many, many years, they always say they're deporting criminals, the, quote, worst of the worst. But these numbers deserve more attention. On June 20th, the Cato Institute released non-public data from ICE. It found 65% of people taken by ICE had no convictions, 93% had no violent convictions. And yet, people across this country are living in a state of constant fear. We told you a couple of months ago that they were even raiding the coffee fields in Kona. There was a raid on Martha's Vineyard. So this is happening in so many places across the country. Today, we're joined by David Bacon, a California-based writer and photographer who's been documenting the lives of migrants and farm workers since 1986. He's the author of many books, including The Children of NAFTA. His latest book is called More Than a Wall. Victoria Petty is staff attorney for immigrant justice at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area. Dr. William Lopez is professor of public health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, and he is author of Separated. His forthcoming book is called Raiding the Heartland, an American story of deportation and resistance. If you'd like to join us, there's so much going on around immigration and deportations. What questions do you have for our guests? If you're working on these issues or if you've been to any actions, you can give us a call. If you've been affected also, give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our discussion about the public media cuts, which will cause KALW to lose $400,000 a year for the next 2 years. Republicans have tried to do this for decades. Donald Trump made it happen. And if you'd like to contribute to KALW or the local public radio station where you get this show, you can go to kalw.org. Your support is needed now more than ever, and we thank you so much. We have to work to keep independent media alive, especially at a time like this. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about the Trump administration unleashing terror in communities across the country to deport 1 million people, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You know, we could do a whole hour on this, but I just wonder what your thoughts are about how we got to this place. I know this is a very big question. The Brookings Institute has a long piece called The Collapse of Bipartisan Immigration Reform, A Guide for the Perplexed. And they look at how the last comprehensive immigration reform was enacted almost four decades ago during the Reagan presidency. They also look at how October of 2023, there was a bipartisan bill that a number of advocates said was actually a pretty conservative bill on immigration. And it was set to pass until Trump walked in and said, nope, we're not going to pass this. And I just wonder what your thoughts are, Bill, about the context that we need to learn more about how we got to this place. I was also thinking about those mass deportation now signs we saw from people at the RNC convention. People were, you know, smiling and waving these mass deportation now signs. And yet now you read that a number of Trump supporters think they're going too far. So what context do we need about when we think about how we got here?
What a great question, right? So how did we get here to where we're waving mass deportation now signs? And I think one of the ways that that happened is throughout much of immigration, our attempts to reform immigration, we've continued to emphasize this deserving and not deserving immigrant narrative, right? And sometimes I totally understand how functional this is. We need to talk about why someone deserves to be here. I've done this myself. We certainly need to say, oh, there's families involved. And that's important. One of the things that it does, though, is it creates this other group of people that we see as deportable. It's one of the things I worry about when we continue to harp on, or perhaps focus on, because it is appropriate, the fact that most people being deported now are not criminals. Very important to think about this, but also important to remember that, let's say we deport the folks who are not quote unquote criminals and we only have quote unquote criminals left, then will we be okay with it, right? Mm-hmm. We want to set ourselves up so that we understand that everyone deserves a certain set of rights, including, as we see, the right to due process, the right to bond. We wish the right to an attorney, though we know that isn't mandated in immigration court. So it's something that I think about a lot, right? How do we push folks to understand that immigration and humane treatment related to immigration can't just be about a deserving few that we select?
Rose, could I add something here?
Please.
Your question also mentions the immigration proposal that was on the table in the last part of the Biden administration. And I think if we look at that proposal, what it actually did was it offered to people who are undocumented, and not everybody, only a small number, really, a kind of a provisional legal status that was dependent on their work. In other words, a kind of a guest worker status, which was the trade-off, supposedly the positive trade-off, in return for huge increases in the budget for enforcement. And in fact, this bill was called by Democrats an enforcement bill, and they attacked the Trump administration for not approving it because it was so hard on undocumented people. And the reason why I think this is important is because we have not had a willingness on the part of political parties in this in the US, especially the Democratic Party, to stand up and actually defend the rights of immigrants in a very principled way. So even going back through all of the immigration compromise bills that we saw during the Bush administration, that we saw during the Obama administration, were bills that, on the one hand, promised a kind of a very limited form of legalization for only part of the millions of people who are here without legal status, but in trade for that, very, very big increases in enforcement and very big increases in guest worker programs. And as a result of that, what we really got is we got the increases in enforcement, we got the increases in guest worker programs, and we did not get legalization. You know, there was a positive bill in the last session of Congress called the Registry Bill, which essentially would allow people without status to normalize their status and would cover almost everybody, everybody who is undocumented in the U.S. now. That bill couldn't get the support of even a majority of the Democrats in Congress, to say nothing of the Republicans. So I think we have a problem here that the reasonable solutions that will give people status and would decriminalize immigration are not ones which are being viewed as being politically possible.
Was this bill, it looks like it got the support of, I think it's important to name names, of Senators Alex Padilla, as sponsored by Dick Durbin, yes, Senator Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and Ben Ray Lujan.
Yes, and in the House, it was sponsored by Zoe Lofgren from San Jose. So they all deserve credit for being willing to advocate for something that actually would solve our people's problems, which is giving legal status to the people who don't have it.
Victoria, what would you like to add from a legal perspective about the context we need to understand how we got here?
I think that something that folks need to understand is that focusing their rhetoric on the quote unquote worst of the worst is always and has always been in tension with the populations that they actually have to target to get to those numbers. There are laws on the books. There's a law, USC section 1226C, that permits the executive branch to detain people who have certain enumerated criminal convictions. And that's been on the books for a long time. It's been the subject of litigation, but they've always been able to detain those individuals. What they're having to do now, this new strategy, is detention has become the heart of immigration enforcement, and they need to get as many veins towards detention to be open, unclogged as possible. And so these strategies include reinterpreting laws that are on the books about the consequences of entering the United States without inspection, for example, or the consequences for seeking certain relief in immigration court. They're reinterpreting on their own accord without any court approval or any normal rulemaking processes, reinterpreting those laws to give ICE discretion to detain people who do not have criminal contacts, who do not have contacts with the criminal legal system, and to make them subject to mandatory detention such that they can be arrested and flow through this pipeline towards detention through to deportation. And so I think another thing that I would add is the almost near exclusive reliance on private prisons as the contractors for operating these huge facilities where they can keep people detained in prison-like settings with limited access to food, medical care, mental health care, access to their families. These private prisons are, you know, the ICE has outsourced all of that labor and responsibility to them. So now there's so much more room to place large numbers of people who, again, you know, it's not enough to say that just because somebody has been convicted of a certain crime, served time in criminal custody, and then is released, they are now possibly subject to ICE detention, that that is just okay. I think we need to, I agree with Bill, that we need to take a much closer look at the narrative and the kind of assumptions underlying that sort of policy. But the new addition is to try to get as many people inside of these detention centers, including people who are not, who have not been subject to any sort of criminal penalties.
Victoria, to that point, Eileen writes in, is this really our country or just some national nightmare we're living through? Will all the detention centers be run by private companies? Then you know that when immigrants are deported, there will be space which needs to be filled. So to Eileen's point, NPR had a piece last month. They report that nearly 90% of people in ICE custody are held in facilities run by for-profit private companies. Two of the largest, Geo Group and CoreCivic, are working to increase their ability to meet the administration's demand. Victoria, we've done so many shows about these private companies over the years. What has really changed in terms of monitoring these companies? And then now that, gosh, $170 billion, it sounds like things are just going to explode. How are you all monitoring what's happening here, especially with all of this new money?
I'll speak specifically about California. So the state of California has made, the legislature has made multiple attempts, some successful, some not, to increase state oversight over the facilities that are within state lines. These facilities are holding, many of them are holding residents of California, so presumably the constituents of the legislature, and issues such as public health, workplace safety, things that are just normal areas of regulation and oversight for the California government. The private prison companies have put in a lot of effort in litigation to strike down those laws that seek to have more public oversight. Thankfully, some of them have survived, and we're still able to gather information from the reporting and the investigations that, for example, the Department of Justice, the California Department of Occupational Safety and Health, those administrations in our state government are able to enter the facilities, conduct interviews, which then the attorneys can read, seek more information about through Public Records Act requests, and understand what the reality is on the ground. In addition to, of course, speaking with our clients are the best witnesses. They are the ones who are enduring the conditions inside of these detention centers. And though they try, of course, the human resilience that you witness from clients on a day-to-day basis working on detention issues is just staggering. Often people who have not ever been criminally incarcerated haven't had to kind of they've never been in this situation. This is an extremely difficult circumstance to be in. And the stories that they share are quite harrowing and I think anybody can empathize with how it would feel to be in one of these places when you hear the conditions. The Disability Rights California also recently issued a report about certain abuses and neglect with relation to access to accommodations that disabled people need in detention. And so there's many sources of information. We have the Freedom of Information Act, which, because these are, even though they're private prisons, and they would love to probably say that all of the information that we're seeking is commercially sensitive information, they are providing a public function, a federal function. And so the ongoings of the inside of these facilities are subject to public oversight via different Records Act requests, which these days usually have to be litigated, unfortunately, and that takes time and resources. So one must also have the will to, you know, stay on the pursuit, because they won't fork this information over easily. Yeah, I think that's what I'd say about that.
Eileen also writes, if people languish in detention centers, then we're paying for their imprisonment now instead of benefiting from their labor. How bizarre is that? Mary writes, thank you for the program. It's horrifying what's happening. What are the best ways to financially help those fighting this and to directly financially help the people and the families directly affected? How can we know the names of those being disappeared, deported, and detained? It's important to know their names. We should be hearing them constantly, and the names of their families, unless it further jeopardizes them. Well, I really want to do a show with the people behind this disappeared website. It's the-disappeared.com. They've got photos and names of people who've been disappeared. I'll just read a couple here. Rodmel, Miguel, Luis, Michael, Tito, Kerbin, Angelo, Yolfron, Albert, Carlos, Victor, Orlando. It just goes on and on and on. And speaking of names, David, we should also talk about the recent piece that you wrote about Jaime Alanis Garcia. Why did this farm worker die in an immigration raid? So this happened during a raid on Saturday, July 12th. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, this was a raid that took place in two farms, two cannabis farms, one in Camarillo and the other one in Carpinteria. And these were basically big greenhouses, what are called grow houses, operated by this company, Glasshouse Farms.
And so, this is an hour north of LA?
About, yes. Okay. So immigration agents arrived in these military transport vehicles. They got out of the vehicles. They went into the grow houses. Supposedly, they had a warrant that allowed them to do this. This is what the company says. Whether they had warrants with the names of the individual people they intended to pick up, I think that's very, very doubtful. But in effect, what they did was they went into the houses and began rounding people up and then putting them into vans in order to transport them to detentions. So what happens in immigration raids that are like this is that people run for wherever they can in order to get away. And one of the people that ran was Jaime Alanis Garcia. And he went up onto the roof of one of the greenhouses. And while he was up on the roof, he fell to his death and broke his neck. So this was a direct result of the fear that he had in fleeing from these immigration agents. And this is basically no surprise, because we have a long record of people dying as they try to get away from immigration raids. And one of the most horrible recent examples of that was what happened to a Mixtec couple, a farm worker couple in Delano a few years ago, who started a border patrol started following them with their lights on. They speeded up their car to get away. The car overturned, and they died in the accident. So this is really the kind of fear that these immigration raids elicit. And again, I think the real point of the raid, or not the only point, but certainly one of them, is to incite this fear. But I think also to see kind of what the response was. You know, within a very short time of the immigration raids, the immigration agents showing up, people's families and activists in the local area came out to the site of these two farms. And this is because I think the people who were inside the grow houses began calling their family members on their cell phones and saying, look, this is happening, you know, help us do something. And so people showed up there, and the response that the agents made to this was to throw flashbang bombs at them, to shoot tear gas canisters at them, treating them as though they were the enemy. There was no violence there. These were people simply who were protesting, or in some cases even seeking to find out whether their family members were being picked up here. But they were being treated in this very, very brutal way, as though they were the enemy. So that's kind of like the story of this raid, but it's really not unique. There are many raids that are taking place in this country right now that look exactly like this.
You know, and David, I was just trying to find an update on Jaime Alanis Garcia. And in today's LA Times, there's a piece about his memorial, which took place just yesterday. He was 56 years old. And, you know, his family shared stories about him with the Los Angeles Times. His niece, Yesenia Duran, says he was hiding, trying to stay alive. He was loved by the community. I mean, David, we'll have to do, we're going to do many more shows about all of this. But, you know, what this does to these families, I feel like in some ways, I'm so glad that you wrote in, Mary, because it's so important to say these names. These are not just numbers. These are people with families.
And also Mary is asking about what people can do to help. And there is an organization on the Central Coast called the 805 Undocu Fund, which is raising money to help the families of people who are victimized in these raids. And also it's important to say, you know, the Trump administration has come up with the names of over 200 nonprofit organizations that is put on a kind of an enemies list. And the 805 Undocu Fund is the number one organization on that list.
Wow. And to think about how much terror has been unleashed, and Vox has a piece about how so many Trump supporters have now turned on what he's doing because it's so brutal. They report on Gallup polling and research from Pew, and it found more Americans now support legalization for Dreamers and undocumented immigrants. Both proposals now have the support of at least 8 in 10 Americans. So we'll definitely continue to follow this. And if you have any show ideas or guest ideas, please email us yourcall@kalw.org. David Bacon is a California-based writer and photographer. He's been documenting the lives of migrants and farm workers since 1986. He's the author of many books, including his latest, More Than a Wall. And I hope you can read his piece, Why Did This Farm Worker Die in an Immigration Raid?, about Jaime Alanis Garcia. Victoria Petty is staff attorney for immigrant justice at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area. Dr. William Lopez is professor of public health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He's the author of Separated. His forthcoming book is Raiding the Heartland. Thank you all so much for joining us, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.